Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, half a century of ecumenical efforts. The Pontifical Council for Christian Unity marks its 50th birthday. Nuclear, no thanks. Why religious organizations are stepping up their campaign for a nuclear-free world. But first, Pope Benedict appeals for the release of a Christian woman in Pakistan condemned to death on blasphemy charges. Asia Bibi, the Pakistani Christian woman whose death sentence has raised an international outcry about the controversial blasphemy laws, was on Pope Benedict's mind this morning as he spoke about the difficult situation of Christians in that country. His appeal for Bibi's release came during his regular Wednesday general audience, as my colleague Ema McCarthy now reports.
Oggi esprimo la mia vicinanza spirituale alla signora Asia Bibi.
On Wednesday, speaking to a crowded St. Peter's Square, the Holy Father joined his voice to that of the international community in expressing his concern for the plight of Christians in Pakistan who are often victims of violence or discrimination. He said, "Especially today, I express my spiritual closeness to Mrs. Asia Bibi and her family, while I ask for full freedom to be restored to her as soon as possible." Pope Benedict added, "I also pray for those who find themselves in similar situations, that their human dignity and their fundamental rights be fully respected."
Ed i loro diritti fondamentali siano pienamente rispettati.
The Pope's appeal came at the end of his general catechesis, during which he returned to a series of lessons on the great female figures of the Church in the Middle Ages, this week focusing on the 13th century Augustinian nun whose devotion to the Eucharist gave rise to the universal feast of Corpus Christi, St. Juliana of Liege.
Intelligent and cultured, she was drawn to contemplative prayer and devotion to the sacrament of the Eucharist. As a result of a recurring vision, Juliana worked to promote a liturgical feast in honor of the Eucharist. The feast of Corpus Christi was first celebrated in the Diocese of Liege and began to spread from there.
In comments in Italian, the Holy Father said that the Church is witnessing a springtime in Eucharistic devotion, particularly among young people who are finding time to stop in silence before the tabernacle to spend time with the Lord. The Pope described this as a wonderful development and specifically mentioned the Eucharistic adoration he led in Hyde Park, London, during his recent apostolic visit there.
I invoke God's abundant blessings.
Then, taking his leave of the square, Pope Benedict XVI imparted his apostolic blessing on all those present. I'm Ema McCarthy.
The Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity is marking its half century this week with a public celebration featuring some well-known faces from the ecumenical world. The Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and the Orthodox Metropolitan of Pergamon, John Zizioulas, joined past and present members of the Pontifical Council on Wednesday to review progress over the past 50 years and to look forward to a new stage of the ecumenical dialogue. As the Council is holding its plenary assembly on that same theme this week, members are seeking to recapture and renew the spirit and vision of Pope John XXIII, who set up the Secretariat for Christian Unity on the eve of the Second Vatican Council.
The world today needs the common witness of Christians. The fact that they are divided hinders the work of the Church, and I do hope that we could all be trustful that the Holy Spirit, which has given us so much grace to walk the path of ecumenical closeness, in the last 50 years, we'll continue to do this.
Bishop Brian Farrell is Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. During the recent Edinburgh Conference on Unity and Mission, I sat down with him to find out more about the founding of his council and his hopes for the ecumenical movement today.
It's interesting, we just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Edinburgh 1910, which symbolically is taken as the beginning of the modern ecumenical movement. And during the conference itself, we remembered the foundation of the Secretariat for Promoting Christian Unity, which was set up in 1960 by Pope John XXIII in order to bring into the discussions of the Council his concern for the unity of Christians. How it happened, it's a beautiful story of the Pope wanting to bring observers from the other Christian churches, the Orthodox and the Protestant churches, to the Council, and having a need for a group of people that would commit themselves to visiting these churches and inviting them to send observers. This was the beginning of the Secretariat. Later, the Secretariat, the beginning of the Council, took on a more formal structure and became instrumental in promoting the various questions that were particularly important to Pope John XXIII and to Cardinal Bea, the first president of the Secretariat, such as Christian unity, freedom of conscience, the question of the relations of the Catholic Church to the world Jewish community. These themes were deeply and at length debated during the Council, and as I have often said, one of the great untold stories is how the Secretariat, during the 4 years of the Council, educated the bishops in the particular issues and questions that were being debated.
An extraordinary achievement, isn't it? Because, as you said, most of these bishops had been educated in an exclusivist Catholic theology. How do you think this great turnaround was made possible? Was it the Pope himself?
Well, of course, the ferment was already in the liturgical, biblical, theological renewal of the first part of the 20th century. But it all came together, if you wish, in the discussions of the Council. The spark being for this new enkindling of Catholic theology, the spark being the particular emphasis given by Pope John XXIII to the question of a renewal of the Church, bringing it into dialogue with the questions of the day, and his insistence on the question of Christian unity, which his experience of living in Eastern Europe had undoubtedly stamped on his soul.
And so he was able in this way to bring so many other bishops on board that it really pushed the work of the Council forward, didn't it?
Well, the Secretariat at that time, as it was called then, worked very hard during the period of the Council and even in the months between the various sessions, organizing study groups, organizing symposia, preparing documents to send to the Council for discussion. During the sessions of the Council, not only were they in constant contact with the observers from all the other churches, meeting with them at least once a week to discuss how the Council was going forward, to bring up the questions that were of interest to the other churches, but also doing a kind of educational effort with the rest of the Catholic bishops so that they would understand the deeper theological questions behind the documents being discussed.
There were those at that time who were very opposed, though, weren't they, to this kind of change?
Well, to move a whole world episcopate from the kind of ecclesiology by which Christians were not visibly members of the Catholic Church were simply considered to be outside the Church, to the point where we have a marvelous document which deserves to be read again and again, Unitatis Redintegratio, a document which recognizes that in all of these communities, and not just in the individuals who are baptized, But in all of these communities, the Holy Spirit works to build up the Church of Christ, and that the work of sanctification and mission is carried out through them.
The ecumenical movement, of course, has been going on for the past five decades, huge changes, and yet it's worked in some places much better than others. What do you think has been the determining factor in really pushing this movement ahead over the past half century?
Well, of course, each part of the world is different. Each country is different from the context. If there are no members or very few members of other churches, and we have a huge majority of Catholics, the sense of need and urgency is perhaps less evident. If, on the other hand, Catholics are a minority, of course they're used to living in that situation, and ecumenism, in other words, relations between churches, are on the menu every day. Other factors, of course, are very important, such as the level of personal commitment on the part of the bishops. This is very important, that they understand that the ecumenical commitment, as all of the popes since John the 23rd have constantly repeated and shown in their teaching and in their pastoral activity, is a priority for the Church. The Council showed us that the division among Christians is not just a scandal. We shouldn't be divided according to the will of Christ, but that it harms the great task of preaching the gospel to the world. The Lord prayed for the unity of his disciples so that the world might believe. And it is clear that the ecumenical movement was founded on this principle, that as long as we are divided, we will not be able to carry out this command that the Lord gave us, to preach the gospel.
The ecumenical work began with the post-Reformation churches, the Anglican, the Lutheran, the Reformed churches. It's now broadened out to include the much newer Pentecostal, evangelical churches mm-hmm. and movements. How has this changed the work that started 50 years ago?
Yeah, I would just like to say that there has never been a time when the question of unity was not important to the Church. And if you go back, we have the councils that tried to restore unity between East and West and so forth. But certainly after the Reformation, the question became much more present and pressing. With the churches of the Reformation period, there has been a substantial dialogue that has been going on now for 40 years. And the results are significant. We have not been able to solve all the questions, all the controversies of the 16th century, but great headway has been made. Now we are also in dialogue with these churches which have grown up during the 20th century under the influence of this new wave of what we might call Protestant communities, which are substantially connected with the experience of the Holy Spirit and a kind of return to the charisms and signs of the presence of the Holy Spirit that we read about, for example, in the Acts of the Apostles. These today are expanding communities. They constitute a large part of the Christian world. We have been in dialogue with some of these groups for decades, more recently with others. But because of a lack of ecclesial structures and an ecclesiology that would give them more structure, it is very difficult to find the people who would actually represent this type of Christianity.
Most of these, or many of these groups, were represented at the Edinburgh Conference at the beginning of June. What do you think, if you had to summarise the real fruits, the results of that conference? Yes.
Well, for the last 15 years, there has been a great interest in the ecumenical world to try to bring the Pentecostal charismatic churches into the ecumenical dialogue. In general, they have been reluctant to do that because of their theological outlook on other Christians. But there is a process called the Global Christian Forum, which has offered them the opportunity to take part in meetings with others, with the Protestant churches of the World Council of Churches and with the Catholic Church, which has been present and works closely with the World Council of Churches, although we are not members. But this recent event in Edinburgh was certainly a step forward insofar as the Pentecostal and charismatic churches felt not just invited, but felt that they had a right to be there, and they took part in a full sense in the activities of this great conference.
So we hope that this will lead on to other significant developments, perhaps.
Well, of course, we're looking at a long journey into the future because the differences in ecclesiology especially, although on fundamental issues we may have greater similarity in questions of Trinitarian doctrine or questions of Christology and the theology of the Holy Spirit, we may agree on many things. We still have to learn from each other who we are, what we stand for, what are the issues that need to be discussed so that we can know each other better and maybe journey together towards greater collaboration and closeness. It's not possible to think that in any short term we will reach any kind of unity. That's not the immediate goal of our conversations with these communities.
But you're hopeful as you look forward to the next half century?
Of course, yes. If you look back 50 years, this council has seen extraordinary changes, progress in our relations with the other churches. I make a point of returning to the great encyclical letter of Pope John Paul II on ecumenism, Ut Unum Sint, in which he says that perhaps the most significant result of this new relationship is what he calls brotherhood rediscovered. In other words, we are no longer fighting each other, we are no longer in rivalry, we are trying to respond to the will of Christ that we should be one.
Thanks there to Bishop Brian Farrell, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. Without nuclear weapons is possible and must be promoted by people of faith in particular. That was the conclusion of a recent seminar organised by the Justice and Peace Arm of the International Union of Superiors General here in Rome. Attended by the President of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, Cardinal Peter Turkson, and the US Ambassador to the Holy See, Miguel Diaz, the conference highlighted points of convergence between the Holy See and the US government over the urgent need to work for nuclear non-proliferation. Though clear differences remain as to how quickly and by what means this can effectively be achieved. Also taking part in the seminar was Japanese Mercedarian missionary sister Philo Hirota, who serves as general counsellor and justice and peace coordinator for her own congregation. She's worked for many years to bring religious organisations on board the campaign for a nuclear-free world. I talked to her about the Catholic Church's changing perspective on nuclear deterrence and her own passionate commitment to this cause.
I know a number of hibakushas, survivors, and especially we are in Hiroshima, and our parish priest, Father Hasegawa, he himself is a survivor, and he has an extraordinary story because he was only 12 years old, And practically he was saved by Father Arupe. And it's such a beautiful story. And he was dying. And he considered this, his meeting with Father Arupe. And he was cured, really. And it's almost like a miracle. And so many, many stories like that. And also I think there is another woman who's a Catholic. She shared her story with the group of Pax Christi who came to Japan. And she said, well, practically all her family members were killed. And she said, now we have this beautiful Hiroshima, but for me, Hiroshima city is a cemetery. And listening to these people, even if it happened long, long time ago, it's so very important. And also that we are very much committed to live or the spirit and the praxis of Article 9 of Japan's constitution, which prohibit categorically any kind of military setup. And once a hibakusha survivor in Nagasaki said, Article 9 is the price of our suffering. So things like that, you know, it's the human suffering. And also it's the story of much solidarity and also like commitment for peace and nonviolence.
These are very powerful stories, yes. But as you say, the survivors themselves are very yes. elderly people. Before yes. long, there won't be many actual survivors left, will there? Which is why it's so important to pass on their message to younger generations.
Yes, very much. And also the majority of course, we have many survivors, but not everybody wants to speak about it. I mean, I would say the majority of them would not want to speak about their terrible experience, but we have some people who are really committed and who went through this transformational conversion, and they feel very strongly that this is their mission. Well, actually, a group of survivors came to Rome. This is a project called Peace Boat, organized by young people. And so 10 survivors came to Rome. So they arrived on Saturday, and they were at the St. Peter's Square, and it was a very beautiful experience.
The Catholic Church in the past was able to justify nuclear deterrence as a form of self-defense, wasn't mm-hmm. it? But that position has changed significantly since the end of the Cold War.
I would say so. Actually, the Catholic Church, I think, came up with a sort of like a statement in the 80s, you know, sort of justifying. But I think we have had several sort of statement and pronouncement criticizing the deterrence theory, and especially the Vatican Observer to the United Nations, which is very, very important because, really, I mean, it's like absurd to think that the violence could stop violence because deterrence is... I mean, you still have nuclear weapons, and to have nuclear weapons means that you're willing to kill, you're willing to use it. So we don't think that the deterrence, I mean, no longer it's viable, it's relevant.
Mm-hmm. There are still plenty of people, including political leaders, who do believe that the threat of nuclear deterrence is an essential factor in their national defense policies.
I think so. I think so. That is the reason why one of the things is that we have to really minimize the use of violence to protect your own safety. But of course, I mean, the situation is now in a way different because now it's not just state-state conflict, but also non-state actors' threat. I mean, they would like to have nuclear weapons. And then also it's because of the situation now, in spite of the fact that the Cold War is over, still there are so many justifications for militarization. So in our case, in Japan, it's North Korea. So North Korea, for us, it's almost like pretext, because Japan is militarized also. It's really unconstitutional. We're not supposed to have any kind of military setup, but we do. And so like a threat could be used, but we believe in nonviolence.
As you say, the main actors, the United States and Russia, have pledged to reduce their nuclear arsenals, haven't they? But the problem, as you say, is with the other states or with, as you say, terrorist organizations.
No, the thing is, you know, I was in the United States this August in Kansas City, and Kansas City has the biggest plant that manufactures nuclear weapon parts. 85% of nuclear weapon parts are manufactured there in Kansas City, and they are going to build a new plant. So you hear there are talks of reduction and everything, but at the same time, you see different sort of scenario. it's a contradiction. But actually, this is what's happening. So we were so happy to hear President Obama's commitment. It was beautiful, really. And then I think really because of his pronouncement, I think the whole sort of like situation is different, because I was in New York this May, and the NPT was very different from NPT 5 years ago. So there is a hope, and there are more sort of like campaigns and people speaking up. But at the same time, you have a different story going on, because arms industry is a very lucrative business.
It is a financial issue, isn't it? Because closing factories means job losses.
That's right. Yes, it is. It is an economic, yes, financial question, because we invited Pax Christi Bishop to Japan right after the election of President Obama. And he told us even a president, I mean, United States president, would find it very difficult to change and transform this military industry complex, which is really almost like a base for the financial economic structure of the United States and the world, I should say. So it's a very, very powerful structure that exists.
Do you feel a little bit like David fighting Goliath?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's exactly. But I think it's so very important to continue articulating what we feel. Because if not, I mean, you see only one story and one justification and one culture, and which is not should be. And now with many people talking about another world, it's possible. And I think we should try to concretize. And when we say another world is possible, what does it mean? That's another world without nuclear weapons also.
And yet a few decades ago, people were very aware of the very real possibility of a nuclear attack. Today, perhaps, they're not so concerned. They're more worried, perhaps, about suicide bombers. It seems to have gone off the public opinion agenda, if you like.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in Japan, we don't talk about it so much. But after the 9/11, for the first time, that anti-terrorism policies or measures became reality in Japan. We have never had anything like that before. Like, for example, you don't have, what you call it, trash bin in public areas, and if you do, they're all transparent. Things like that. You know, I mean, this terrorism, the reality of terrorism has entered into the daily life of people. And then that means that's bad, because then you are afraid. And this is what happened after 9/11. You're fearful, and you have enemy. An enemy is somebody that you have to kill. An enemy is somebody that you want to disappear. And that has become sort of the dynamic in our daily life. And I think we should come up with something different, because we can just let, you know, this fear, culture of fear and hatred, fear and hatred, dominate our life or our options.
How much do you think the voice of the church can help to change this atmosphere of fear and hatred?
I think the church leaders should be very articulate about this. I mean, Pope has been very, he's been talking. And I think the Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace is also very important. And I think in this sense, the Catholic social teaching is important. Although there are people who feel uncomfortable about, you know, church speaking, I mean, politics, you know. But I think it's very, very important. And then we can always substantiate our commitment to nonviolence from the gospel, from Jesus.
My thanks there to Mercedarian Sister Philo Hirota, General Counselor and Justice and Peace Coordinator for her congregation. And that's all from us here at the English Programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.